Hello and welcome to this episode of Let's Talk About by Kangaroo Minds. I am Vedika and today we have with us Dr. Amanpreet Kaur. Dr. Amanpreet Kaur is a clinical psychologist with over 12 years of training and clinical experience and has done her PhD from NIMHANS Bangalore. Dr. Kaur is an associate professor as well as the associate dean for research at the O.P. Jindal Global University under the Jindal School of Psychology and Counseling. Dr. Kaur has also worked in several global public health initiative. She has managed both national and international projects alongside working with the community. And her research interests include mindfulness, palliative care, grief, mental health stigma, amongst others. Before we begin our conversation today with Dr. Kaur, where we're going to talk about grief and understanding loss, we would like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. And now, without taking much time, we'll hear from Dr. Kaur. Dr. Amanpreet, welcome back to the episodes. It's lovely to have you once again with us today.
Lovely to speak to you again, Vedika. I think the last episode was fun and I hope it helped people.
It absolutely did. I think, the conversation we had the last time was also on something so important, which was, around talking about mental health, talking about, how to seek help and how to access help. And, even today, the conversation that we're going to have is close to a lot of people's heart. And I think it, of course, affects each one of us, and that's around grief and, loss. But before we start talking about grief and bereavement and things, do you want to give us a little bit around, the narratives that we have around, death and dying? So that could sort of set the tone for the rest of our conversation.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to begin a conversation also, Vedika. I would say that, death is something. I think the reason we gave the trigger warning, I think it's great you did that. People have started talking about death. People have definitely, some of the people have started talking about grief because they have gone through it. Pandemic, which we all lived through and experienced, I think that also has contributed a lot in terms of that. We have seen an upsurge of cases, not only cases, but an awareness about how to deal with it because everybody was struggling with it throughout. And that, leads us to think about the fact that why is it happening around that only? We all celebrate life, right? We all have birthdays. We all celebrate and prepare for the, arrival of a baby. However, we struggle when we have to think about death of a loved one, leave apart death of a loved one, death of a colleague, death of a pet, death of anybody around us, right? And it leaves us in such unpleasant, difficult situations that you do not know how to act or react. We don't know what's the normal or the abnormal way to behave. And that's the reason I think there's so much mystery behind it. And I would say there's a lot of difference between, across the generations also when we see that. Our generation or, the generation before us have not seen so many deaths within the family or witnessed so many deaths. Why? Because I think the medical advancements, increased age of, the life expectancy and so many vaccines and so many things are happening as compared to the earlier times, 50s, 60s, 70s. That is also one reason, we don't get to see people, we don't get to even live the rituals. And that's what happened during COVID. People were struggling with it. And another fact being social support was also not there. Where will you sit? With whom will you do the ritual? How will you grieve? And then comes the difference of that, how do we talk about it? So, interestingly, because we come from this culture where we have so many mythological stories and narratives around it, and it's just so beautiful when we had the concept of Gurukul. We used to have these stories through which people used to learn. And, the two things which come to my mind, I remember, one is Krisha Gautami or Krisa Gautami, whatever you call it. So during the era of, Buddhism, because Buddhism is a very recent religion, it's 500, 600 years ago only. And we all know about Buddha and my interest and speciality being in mindfulness. That's how I stumbled upon this story. So Krisha Gautami has her loved son, and she had got the son after so many, the mannats and everything. And she lost the son. And once she loses the son, people start calling her that, you know, what has happened to her? Because it, for the others, it was an exaggerated form of grief, the way she was crying and sobbing and she was in sorrow throughout. So somebody suggested her to go and meet Buddha. She goes and meet Buddha, asks for the fact that how can I, you know, get my son back? She was grieving for the son. And Buddha said, sure, I'll help you out. But what you have to do before that is, she was like, I'm ready to do anything. Buddha listened to her and told her, why not do one thing? Just go and visit any of the houses and get me a handful of mustard seeds from that house where no death has ever happened. She said, sure. She roamed around the whole village, visited all the houses, and at the end realized what was happening. And that was, I think, the path to enlightenment, right? So, you know, that's also somewhere we relate that it could be a form of psychotherapy also anyway. You know, then she comes to the fact that, you know, she'll have to accept it. And, you know, it's something which is integral. It'll happen to everybody. Second story, or it's not a story, but it's more of a myth. We all know about the Pandavas, the eldest Pandava being Yudhishthir. And, you know, so during the end of the exile, the 12-year exile, so he happens to, they are looking for water and he happens to stumble upon this guy called Yaksh. So the stories or this particular part is known as Yaksh Prashna in Mahabharata. And Yaksh asks him a lot of questions. And one of the questions was that, what is the most wonderful thing? And he answered that the most wonderful thing is that all of us, all of the human beings, we all know that we are going to die. However, we live as if nobody's going to die. We are immortals. So, you know, coming back to the fact that nobody would want to talk about it, as if it will cause somebody's death, while think about the fact if we are well prepared for it, you know, probably we'll talk about it towards the end. If we are well prepared for it, we know how to do, what to do, where are the documents, where are the insurance papers, where are my property papers, you know, your spouse and your kids know about it. Then half of the, you know, anxiety goes from there, and probably more time would be given for them to be able to grieve. So,
no, I think it's interesting that, you know, you brought this up, because as you said, like, you know, since death is inevitable for all of us, somewhere so is grief, right? Because, and it's sort of a natural response to loss. So, but when we talk about grief, a lot of times we confuse grief with bereavement and mourning. So can you just, you know, give a little bit about, you know, what your understanding is of grief and how do we distinguish between these terms?
I think the simplest way to understand is, and I remember, you know, my co-guides, you know, co-mentors words, loss of a loved one is bereavement. Psychological reaction to it is grief. Social reaction to it is mourning. And any loss can cause grief. It's not that only death of a person would cause grief, right? It could be death of your loved one. It could be death of a pet. It could be a psychological loss also. You know, it could be loss of or transfer of, you know, a family home where you spent your whole childhood. It could be a breakup. It could be loss of a job. It could be loss of your house or something which was really, really precious to you. So the loss could be anything. So, but loss of a loved one definitely is bereavement. And I'll repeat, psychological reaction to it, what we experience, that is grief. And the social reaction to it is mourning. You know, when we say that people come visit you, you know, you do the rituals, social rituals, that is part of mourning.
Right. No, I think that's a very good way to, you know, like remember and sort of distinguish between the three terms. But, you know, you spoke about grief a little bit. You spoke about, you know, even in the stories that you shared around how people sort of react to grief. And of course, different people go through different reactions. But, you know, in your practice, and what would you say are the more common psychological, emotional reactions to grief?
We call it symptoms or the reactions. Let's just call it as psychological reactions. How would people, you know, listening to this, probably the interview could make sense out of it. Physically, they could feel fatigue. There could be different aches, you know, in the body without any, you know, origin to it. They could feel nausea. They could also have sleep disturbances, majorly insomnia. They can't fall back sleep. There could be appetite loss also. There could be different pains in the body without any evidence for it. And at the same time, when we talk about the psychological reactions to it, the person may be in shock. The person may feel numb also. I think numbness is seen usually. People feel emotionally numb. They can't feel anything anymore. There's this sense of, during that time when that happens initially, there's this sense of disbelief also. There could also be anger towards the whole situation, that why and how did that happen? A person may be in guilt as well. There may be blame onto your own self. You're trying to blame others. Crying spells could be there. It could mimic the symptoms of depression also. Some people have also reported having fear and panic attacks as well. So, and the sense of helplessness and, you know, hopelessness, that you can't really do anything about it. You would have wanted to do so much. You would not want to lose this person or, you know, that whole thing, but you couldn't do anything about it. So I think those are the majorly, you know, different types of reactions a person may come with.
I think, you know, when, as you said, like different people are going to experience grief very differently. But before we talk a little bit more about, you know, where we're going with the symptoms of grief, there's also a lot of conversation about like the different forms that grief can take. You know, you briefly spoke about, you know, preparing for someone's passing, you know, whether it's towards the end of their life. And of course, you have the interest in, you know, death anxiety, and you've worked in a space of palliative care as well. So you know how, you know, for instance, anticipatory grief kind of plays out. And then there's also a lot of discourse now around complicated grief. So do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, these forms of grief?
Absolutely. I think, so let's start off with anticipatory grief. People may talk about, okay, fine, now I understand this is what grief is. This is how, you know, the reactions are. And then you will come across things like complicated grief, complex grief, prolonged grief disorder. You know, now we are aware about that. And as per ICD-11 and DSM, there is something called, you know, a fitness grief also, which talks about how your grief should have matched the rational grief. Right, you know, as per the magnitude of the loss, that this should have been the grief, but they end up saying that, but in reality or in practicality, you do grieve lesser than what is expected out of you. That is also there. So what is the fit of your grief? And then you have something called, you know, chronic grief, delayed grief, exaggerated grief, and masked grief. These are the different forms of complex grief, we would say. Complex grief is anything which doesn't follow the usual route, we would say. What is the usual route? There is no such written rules for a usual route. There is no right or wrong way to grieve, right? There is no such normal process. We just say 1 to 2 years, you know, it may take for a person. It could take longer. It could take, you know, lesser than that also. You can never be sure about it, because it depends on the person's personality, life experiences, coping strategies, support from others. So many factors are there. So complicated grief, you know, is all those things, you know. So usually we say that when a person experiences grief longer than a certain period of time, then you can classify it as something that this needs help. This is not following the usual route. So let's say, you know, diagnostically speaking, when we say prolonged grief disorder, I think recent years ICD-11 and DSM-5 talks about it. Now it's a diagnostic criteria for that, that there is this persistent and disabling grief, persistent longing for the one you have lost. There's this persistent cognitive preoccupation about the whole thing, you know, and you're not able to let go of that. There is this intense emotional pain. You know, this is how they describe it as, and the death could have happened at least a year ago. since the, symptoms have begun. So that means for adults, it's at least a year. And for children and adolescent, it's at least 6 months. So beyond that, if the symptoms are continuing in such a way, persistently, that means persistent means that every day they are going through the same thing. It's not that they went for a movie and suddenly their mood was okay. Not really. So that is diagnosed as, prolonged grief disorder. Earlier, grief was, if it was depression, it would be mentioned that, it should not be grief. It should not be because of death of somebody else, right? So I think now we are finally considering it as a category and trying to treat people. And I think that is amazing because here suicidal ideations could also come. And there is the self-blame also, which may be there. And it's so difficult to, treat or handle regrets and self-blame. Masked grief, which is part of complex grief or complicated grief, that means that, the person has not even cried, which we see often around us also, that, this person is not even crying. What has happened? And people will try. So that's how mourning helps. That's what was lacking during the time of COVID, where everybody comes and you follow certain social rituals. There's a reason why we have symbol. So these are all symbolicism, there's no other significance of 12 days or 13 days. We do Teravi, some people do Chautha, some people do, and 1 year ka anniversary. It differs from the culture and the society the person comes from. However, we see it's almost similar. So you're giving, society is giving you time and space to grieve so that you can grieve, you can cry, you can long for the one, and then you can come back to your usual routine gradually and slowly. So sometimes people may think that what kind of rituals, we don't believe in these rituals, but all these rituals really are helpful,
so I think you've touched upon the whole social aspect of grieving and sort of a little bit about how culturally people go through grief. But do you want to tell us a little more about, in terms of how do these cultural beliefs and religious beliefs that people hold, how does that somewhere influence, the whole grieving process for them?
So, see, there are some societal beliefs. I think we have touched upon already, you were rightly saying it, a lot of things here and there while talking. When we talk about societal beliefs, we all know that how impactful death of a child is, death of a young person is. Why? Because societally, we're not saying religious or culturally. Societally, we believe that the person has not even, or the kid or the child has not even seen the, life yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Although we all know that it can happen to anyone at any time. You cannot control these things. But that is one belief. And you would find the professionals also who are working in the area of, pediatric palliative care or kids who are going through, who have been diagnosed with terminally ill or they're terminally ill because of cancer or because of any other illness. It's so difficult for them also to handle that and to process that. The parents, it's so difficult for them, right? So these are societal beliefs which we have that, a life lived very well. So if a person dies at the age of, let's say 95, 100, that is okay, still okay. And they'll call it as natural death. When you'll talk to people, I think all of us have been part of that process. When you talk to people, you'll ask, or people will ask you, oh, was it a natural death or something else happened?
Mm-hmm.
What exactly happened? And people are okay with the fact that it was a natural death. What's a natural death?
Yeah.
Person goes through something, right? It could be a heart attack. It could be something else. If they die peacefully, and I've seen many people talking about the fact that we would want no suffering in our life. This is another belief also that, a death without suffering. So we should die only in our sleep. That will be the best death. So we do have thoughts and, misconceptions about death. And, nobody talks about what happens post that. When we talk about religious, beliefs about death, so interestingly about suicide and the way you die, that is talked about. The way you live your life, that is talked about, right? And that's the reason people, when they are on their deathbed, they start thinking of what they have done and what they have not done. They think about karmas probably, right? All these theories are prevalent. But ultimately, in terms of doing the rituals for morning, those could be very different, the way you do the rituals, but these are all similar because they all help you out, right? So that's what I'm saying. Your faith also helps you in terms of grieving, in terms of mourning. So it's really, really helpful. And it's not necessary that somebody might be an atheist also. So you could probably follow your own self-care rituals or spiritual rituals for the same. So culturally, it really matters, you know, the kind of background you're coming from, what kind of things you have thought about death, the understanding about it, right? So that's the reason I spoke about that in our scriptures, it's talked about, but we don't talk anymore to the kids. We don't talk anymore. How many friends talk about that? I think the mental health professionals, I think because of our training and experience, we do end up talking about it openly. There's something called Death Cafe, which has come. Palliative care, you know, you have hospices, you have so many movements happening. But apart from that, when I remember very clearly, you know, let me share a personal experience, and I might be digressing also from the topic. Many years back, when I had just started doing my PhD, and then I spoke to my parents that you should know where all my passwords and everything, and you know, all these things are in case something happens to me. They were terrified. They thought something has gone wrong with this girl post going to Bangalore. But then I think again and again, I spoke about it, and then fortunately, unfortunately, the whole COVID episode. That makes you believe, and then, you know, all of us have experiences. I have had an experiences of, you know, witnessing one of my very, you know, one of my dear ones passing in front of me, which was very difficult to handle, right? And somehow you get into certain kinds of streams accordingly, the way it becomes your interest area. You know, but not everybody is lucky enough to talk about it, to bring it forth, and to even work on it in a healthy way. So that's the whole approach, that more and more you talk about it with people, probably, you know, even if it helps one person, that's good to go. But now I'm very, very happy to say that when I talk about death, others are also doing the same thing in my family. So they are quite okay with it. We are quite prepared what to do, what to expect. What will happen? We don't know. I don't know. Nobody knows, but at least we have an intellectual understanding of what can be done, probably. That's it.
No, I think, you know, as you said, you know, when we talk about the cultural nuances around grief and the religious beliefs that people have about grief and grieving and sort of the whole mourning process as well, I think there is something common universally. I mean, you know, whether it's about the time, whether it's about, you know, a death anniversary, whatever we may call it just gives people some sort of milestones, as you said, to, you know, grieve and make sure they've had some sort of closure. But, coming back to the cultural aspect of grief, when we talk about culture, we talk about religion, we talk about, you know, all the things that come with it, especially around death and grieving, and even if it's about anticipatory grief for that matter, what role do you feel that, you know, that cultural competence plays when it comes to support someone who's grieving?
Absolutely. So I think when we talk about what suggestions we can give, we could probably talk in detail about that. But specifically talking about the cultural competence, there is no such guideline given to, you know, any of the culture or by the culture, except for the fact that there are certain rituals to be done. And if the rituals are not being done, so, you know, you become part of the whole process. Somebody, let's say, take for example, somebody has passed away, you know, maybe in your family or in the neighbor's side. Everybody will ensure that whatever the relationships is with that person or that family, or it was, you would just be part of that whole, you know, during that period, because it's considered to be a crisis period. It is supposed to be the time of sorrow. And you would just go as society, you know, being part of that culture to go and support that person. That is one thing, I think, which I've seen irrespective of religion, irrespective of your beliefs with God or, you know, whatever your personal beliefs are. So culture plays a big, big role. And I don't think we can actually, Vedika, delineate or differentiate, culture from society. I think it's the same which we've been talking about. So society, religion plays a lot of role in helping you to come out of that whole process. And that's what we say that, hold on to your faith also. That also helps you because a person who's grieving, I think we missed out on talking about it, also withdraws socially. They do not want to talk to anyone. They may withdraw spiritually also. Many times we see that, they feel that, what did we get out of the whole thing? We were praying to the God, we were doing everything, but what did the God do? Take away my loved one from me. So there might be this anger towards others too, including your own faith. So, what others can do as society, you will see most of the time somebody having greater social support, friendships, and, people around them, to help them. They would, be grieving in a very healthy way. You would see them coming back to or reintegrating back to their usual routines soon or sooner enough as compared to somebody who probably did not have any social support around. And they say the research wise, I think it's 7 to 10% of bereaved individuals who would have experienced the loss. Bereavement is that, right? 7 to 10% might go through, or be diagnosed with prolonged grief disorder. That's what the data says, and that's a big number.
7 to 10% is a huge number when we talk about any mental illness, especially in terms of grief. But when we talk about prolonged grief disorder, do you feel somewhere that we're over pathologizing grief? Because grief is something, everyone's going to experience, and especially, as you said, it's something new in the DSM, it's something new in the ICD. It's come at a time post the pandemic where people have lost. They haven't sort of had that chance to have social support, as you also rightly pointed out. People have had to go through a lot of their grief alone. They've not had that, interaction to sort of, even during mourning, like the rituals exist so that people get some solace, some comfort in being with other people. What are your thoughts around that?
See, when I teach clinical psychology also, this is one thing we talk. So classification or diagnosing or labeling, any kind of labeling, it is helpful. For sure, it is helpful to communicate, to talk about it, right? And to communicate it within the professionals, to the patients or their families. However, there is this always, when we say over-pathologizing or stigmatizing or labeling something, surely. But then, we need to see the positive aspect of it also, Vedika, because earlier they were probably, left. I'll talk about some recent cases also, where the person was not given the medication on time because there was this context of, so she was coming from this context that only 5 months ago, she had the loss of her husband, which is considered as, I think the highest in terms of that stressors. But she was not given medication. She was just asked, other people were just told that, please take care of your mother. It's okay. And, it was more of a mask creep. It was very clear. She was not going through counseling, what to do. And they wanted her to be given medications. But the psychiatrist, it's not that he took a wrong decision, but he tried that, no, right now medications are not required. Let's see for some time if there is any psychosis or anything else which is needed, it will come up, obviously. And then after 1 month, we see that, there is one suicide attempt made by her, high on lethality and modality. So you can never know. You can never be clear about these things. And so, yes, we may be diagnosing it and putting it into categories, which should not be the process, because now I think all of us are going towards that dimensional approach that everything exists on a continuum, right? However, we need these diagnoses, because there are so many people who would need help, who would need probably right sort of treatment for the same as well. And rather than just saying, oh, this person is grieving, no need. It's fine. It's natural. No, it's not, because somebody having, let's say, hallucination, somebody, you know, specifically talking about when somebody is not able to carry out their daily day-to-day life activities the way they used to do it earlier, and it has been going on and on since months. So, and I think so we can have a category that, you know, for 12 months it's happening, you know, and the person has not recovered at all. There is no change in the process. The person might be hearing or seeing things also, which happens in grief, right? Normally and naturally, but it is, if it is happening persistently and this persistent longing is there, so definitely the person would help, would be helped with this. And, you know, so yes, there are pros and cons of it. You're rightly saying it, but it is what it is.
No, I think, as you said, you know, like it just sort of helps. Sometimes the label will help people get the support that they need. And you also touched upon times when, you know, people should seek help professionally if they're struggling with grief, because we do forget that, right? Like a lot of times we feel ki haan, it's a phase, theek ho jayega, like it's going to pass. And that may not be the case for a lot of people. But talking about, you know, phases and things around grief, of late, there's a lot of conversation around the stages of grief. And we spoke about grief being on a continuum and things. So do you want to throw some light on the stages of grief? And, you know, do you feel that people necessarily go through it as stages, or is it more of a fluid process?
Yeah, so stages of grief is not recent. Stages of, so there's somebody called, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You would have heard the, you know, name. And if whoever is interested in this area, please go and read her books. These are amazing. So she's written amazingly on death, dying, grief. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had given stages of grief, five stages of grief, and which is, one is, first stage is denial. Second stage, according to Kubler-Ross, is anger. Then you have bargaining. Then you have depression. And then you have ultimately acceptance, when you have the meaning of it and you, you know, go back, reintegrate into, you know, the back into your usual rules. So now the fact says, you know, the question, is it stage wise? Is it for everyone? How do we make sense out of it? So no, nobody follows it stage wise. Maybe there might be people who might follow it stage wise, right? But usually, it's like a roller coaster. You know, if you just see it in practice and otherwise, it's just a roller coaster of emotions, and there are so many ups and downs. One day you might be in one stage, and another day you might be in another stage, and one day you may feel yes, you have accepted it, and you know you're fine. And then again, there might be anniversary, or you know the trigger might be there, and you will just end up crying with that, you know, that grief and that love in your heart, looking at the mirror, not knowing what to do and how to help you out, and then again you're fine. So there is no such normal processes, or there is no such, you know, set pattern that this is how it is. Then, so these are different theories. But when we talk about anticipatory grief, you would definitely see these stages coming up, because there you are aware about it initially. So first stage, or when the person comes to know that, you know, probably you just have these many months to live, and, you know, so how the person react to it psychologically, how a person is going to grieve to it will vary from person to person. So yes, it's more fluid rather than, you know, category wise, it's not really exclusive. And there's another theory which talks about, you know, the spiral bound theory, that, you know, how it's like a spiral, there could be ups and downs also. Then there's this third thing which talks about reintegration, that it's, I'm not able to remember the name of this person, but this theory talks about how integration, the reintegration back into your, you know, so people sometimes say and talk about, Vedika, I'm pretty sure you would relate with it, that, you know, there is this void. Earlier, let's say, you know, a person loses the wife, and everybody else around this person is saying, go to this, do that. They are not realizing the fact that, you know, this person did so many things. The whole life was around, centered around this woman. And so many things were done by her only and not done by him. And suddenly you want him to become all normal, all set, and you know, get to go. This person is going to take some time to learn those new skills probably and to get back to normal, because everywhere this person will see would remind of that person. It's not that that thing or that song or that particular place belongs to that person who has left the world, but you associate certain memories with those places and those songs. And that's the reason we say more and more the person, you know, becomes okay with it, will talk about it, will go to these places, will expose themselves to those unpleasant emotions, will sit with it, the more chances it that a person will be able to get back to the normalcy. But the fact being, at the same time, this person may not want to, you know, lose that longing, because that's the only thing which would probably bring him or closer to the only thing which would be memories, right? And you cannot control those memories. Now we are saying that, you know, just let it go. We don't really talk about letting it go. We do read that in Vedas and Puranas. But how many of us are actually practicing letting it go and acceptance? So to come to that stage of acceptance, definitely acceptance is the final stage, you know, emotionally when we let it sink in. Intellectualizing it, sure, people do it very well with self-help books and otherwise. But emotionally, I think that level of acceptance, once that comes, then you become really, you can say that, yes, I'm back to, you know, the usual mode of adaptation, and I'm living my life in a healthy way.
It's very interesting how you touched upon, you know, like, especially in couples when, you know, one partner sort of passes away and the impact on the other individual. And we definitely see that a lot with the elderly. Right, like, because they've lived together for so many years, there's obviously a healthy dependence sort of which develops between two people, but also with children, you know, because somewhere children experience emotions differently. For a lot of children, you know, like, for instance, a grandparent passing away is their first experience with grief and loss, actually more bereavement and loss, and of course then grief. So do you feel that the experiences of grief sort of vary between age groups? For instance, you know, like young children and elderly and like young adults, for instance.
Absolutely. The experience would differ from each person to, you know, the second person for sure, and age group surely. But, you know, the way we help them out, I think that's where, you know, we don't know how to help them out. When we are talking, so the kids usually do not understand. For kids, permanent loss and, you know, permanently somebody has gone away. The person who was there, let's say a parent or a grandparent you just mentioned, and the next day they may not be there. So they will not understand that, where have they gone? They will ask such questions. Sadly, people end up using euphemisms also. You know, euphemisms are, for example, they may say that the dead body is there, but rather than explaining it to them, so yes, they will not understand you know, the existentiality of the whole situation, that permanently somebody can leave also. There's something called death. But they do understand, and if you put some meaning to it and some story around it, they can actually regulate very well as compared to an adult. The point is here, people just behave that, no, please don't see. One. Secondly, they might say that, you know, oh, he or she or they're just sleeping, don't worry. Wo so rahe hain, aap unhe disturb mat karo, aap andar chale jao, right? And they would try to make it a very hush hush affair that, you know, oh no, the child should not come in contact with anything because it might be traumatic for them. Yes, it is traumatic for them whenever they'll come to know about the fact that, oh, that this had happened and I did not know about it. That would also, anything could be. But the fact stays here that the child can start becoming fearful of the fact that, you know, sleeping is scary. Last time my grandparent or my father or my mother, who was sleeping, who was probably in deep sleep, that is how it was explained to them, they never came back to life. They never talked to me post that. And you might see bedwetting cases of anxiety with kids, because it has been explained like that. And that's how the belief system also, you know, that's why we talk about in therapies also early experiences of the person. Secondly, you know, they They actually adjust very well. If you give them structured routines, if you give them, if their routine is all structured, if they know, after this, do that. So they can actually become okay. They can actually cry and then get back, normal again for the kids, as compared to an adult, probably where you'll see persistently, emotion being there. So here with them, you could talk about that, how a person in symbolic ways, for example, there are stories that, the Dadaji now is the Tara. Look at the sky. You can talk to that star also, or you can talk to the moon, and that's how it can stay with you. So that kind of process will probably help more, a kid as compared to obviously somebody else. Secondly, apart from the routines and the support, let them express the way they would want to express. We have play, we have painting, we have stories. So I had come across this really small storybook. I've forgotten the name of it, and I think it was meant for the kids. So I bought one and I've kept it somewhere. I was trying to find it to be able to show it. So Friedrich Nietzsche, I think all of us are aware about this person. He's written great books, and this small storybook talks about how you can explain the concept of death to a child. So I think there is nothing wrong about introducing the concept of death to a child. It might be very difficult initially, but then they will also understand that, yeah, these things do happen. We watch movies, we see things, but you will see that they struggle with the fact that, oh, death means gone. They're not going to come back. And that may cause anxiety to the kid also. But yes, definitely there are strategies, there are procedures to follow, and with which, they can be helped.
Right. And I think you really touched upon really well, how do we talk to children about death and dying? Because, for instance, saying things like, how, okay, they've come back from the hospital, they're not going to wake up, or, that they're resting, or that they're peaceful. Then children have further questions, which, okay, but will they be sitting? Will they be standing? Will they get up? When will I get to meet them? And then when you start using euphemisms like, okay, they've gone to Bhagwanji, for instance, how have they gone there? And then you just kind of go into this spiral where you just lose answers. And typically people also lose their patience while trying to answer. So I think, as you said, it's more fair to have open conversations about, the loss, about dying, about grief with children, and giving them that time. But just sort of coming back to older adults, like, when they experience grief, essentially, it's not always about their companion, but sometimes even as they start seeing people around them dying, right? Like their circle starts shrinking and shrinking smaller. How do you feel that whole loneliness that starts creeping in and things affects how they start viewing death?
I think what exactly they might be experiencing, we don't know. Exactly, we don't know. But what we understand, with the conversations and otherwise, I think there is this sense of, they know that they are also going to die very soon. You would probably, you'll see the healthier adults, talking about it very openly that, yeah, it might happen to me. If that happens to me, probably do this. And, talking about, when we're talking about kids and elderly, kids may not be benefiting from doing the rituals. But the elderly or the adults would definitely be benefited, because kids cannot understand these abstract things, but elderly can understand this. Secondly, we also talk about that, how the concept of retirement. So people stop doing certain things and they become more and more dependent on their kids and on others. It's something, try not to do it. So, let them be engaged. If you have an elderly parent or an elderly partner, let them be engaged into things, let them learn certain things. I remember one of the cases where this person struggled to even operate a smart TV. That's okay, 70-year-old. And now the husband's, has passed away, and this woman did not know how to handle the bank work, how to even operate the channels. And she would just go and sit alone. Her friend circle, as you rightly mentioned, the loneliness part, her friend circle, had more younger, females, who had their own families, grandkids, and they were busy with their own families. And she felt, oh my God, with whom should I go and talk to? We don't have the concepts yet, your popular concepts of having anonymous groups and, support groups. And counseling psychotherapy, any which ways, there's still so much stigma around it, although we are still working on so much of awareness. Because they would say, oh, nothing has happened with me, nothing is wrong with me. You don't have to have something wrong with you to go and speak to a therapist or a mental health professional. So, if a parent who has lost somebody, and second part, you will also see many a times people within the same family, they would try to avoid talking about the person who, they have lost recently. Why? Because they think that might trigger some emotions which they cannot handle. I think that is something which there is no need to avoid certain things. So it's okay to cry. It's okay to sit with the person, even if you do not know what to do, how to say things, because we do end up saying things which we shouldn't have said, rather than, letting that person say whatever comes to that person's mind. So yeah, I mean, the way kids react to it, the way elderly react to it, and the way things may help them, it's very, very different. The context is different. The generation is different. The way they understand is also different.
Right. So, you spoke about talking about the person who's passed away, right? Like who's no longer here. And a lot of times, as you rightly said, we avoid those conversations because it makes us very uncomfortable. That no, let's not, go down that path. It's not time again. Like, why are we reopening, old wounds? But that can also be very helpful for a lot of people to, remember their loved ones, to, keep them alive, sort of in a way. So how do you feel that, maybe for someone who's lost, how can we more like in a healthy manner sort of, remember our loved ones or celebrate their legacy and honor their memories?
Absolutely. I think it's very, very important to do that, and sometimes, let's a friend of mine or a person who've been working with, as colleagues, they would probably not question these things because we all are talking in the same terms. But somebody probably, let's say, and this has happened, so out of concern, when I ask, when is the death anniversary, and do you do certain rituals? So these people do give me some looks at who ask these questions, because people do not ask these questions in general. Ultimately, they also like the fact that somebody's asking these questions and they could share these things. And sometimes people have not thought about it, right? And they start thinking about it, that how can they honor their loved one? That is also, a part of the whole grieving process, because it's a very natural process to grieve for somebody, you've had so much of love for. And I read it somewhere that, grief is nothing but all that love which you could not give, and it's there with you, and you felt that, longing within your, so you feel that intense emotional pain in your chest area, maybe because that's how they say that love is connected to heart. I don't know what the symbolicisms are, but this is how it is. So Dr. Kenneth Toka, if we talk about, the science behind it or the research behind it, so he has talked about four rituals of continuity, right? So one is definitely continuity, how you can maintain the continuity. For example, cooking that certain, certain meals. Let's say somebody has lost a parent, and the parent really loved gulab jamun. I'm just saying, assumption, example. And you would end up making that on some special day, or maybe the birth anniversary or the death anniversary, not because that you have not come to terms with it, but you are celebrating it and you're remembering that person. Some cultures say, and some, I think, societal beliefs, some, I'm saying some, region-wise it could be different. So no offense to be taken here by anyone, but it happens in certain areas, in certain cultures, that they do not use the things which actually belong to that person who's deceased. But then there are people who do not believe in these things also, you see, in the current generation, and they would want to keep those things, not because they want to maintain the continuity, not because they want that person to come back, but they would want to feel closer to that smell, and on certain special days, and to honor that loved one, to wear that sari of the mother probably. There's something called, transition also. This, one of the rituals, they say. Transition ka matlab hai that, the room might be there intact. You see certain people doing it, not touching it, not even going inside it out of fear. And during, the time, and once the person is okay with it, once the person comes, to terms with it, they can probably at their own pace clean it out. gradually, you know, and become okay with the fact. Then you have affirmations also. You know, these are different rituals. Affirmation rituals are something, you know, which I personally really like, which has helped many, many of my clients. And otherwise, also, I've seen it happening, you know, when we talk to people. So writing letters, right? Or poetry, if happens, you know, you happen to be a person with that poetic stance to you. Or, you know, writing, there are certain memorials also which were done in social media, let's say, you know, with the help of that, or writing posts and, you know, posting with that picture. It's not happening on an everyday basis, but whenever you miss them, and specifically during the anniversary times. And then there's something called intensification gap also, where you have the awareness of the same. So there are different ways or different rituals, the way, you know, as you correctly stated, that how you can honor your loved one. Some people also maintain a scrapbook that helps them, you know, with certain memories, certain, you know, what kind of memories you really liked with that person, whoever that person was, and based on the relationship. So to rather than to remember the regrets around it and what you could have done or not done, because the fact stays, it has nothing to do with us. We don't decide anybody's life. We don't decide anybody's death. We do not have that power yet. After 100 years, if we have it, I can't say anything about it. But right now, we don't have so much of power to do that. And so these are just the only ways where we can just probably continue to live and honor the person who was probably one of the, you know, loved ones, the best person in the world for you.
You touched upon social media, and I know that is, you know, one of your interest areas of work and research. Do you think social media has somewhere changed the way we grieve, or we experience grief, or even the way we show grief?
That's a very complicated question, I would say. So social media, see, the recent generation, you know, so I teach also, so the Gen Z and then the Gen Alpha, they are very, very, I think, oriented and acquainted with social media platforms as compared to us. And even, you know, the other people, we have probably certain timings where we'll go. But, you know, certain generations, the recent ones, they will just be on social media all the time. And yes, there are effects on mental health also. Now, when we talk about grieving, it has its own pro and cons to it, Vedika. This is what I think, you know, as a professional and as a person. It can help you, you know, holding certain, you know, let's say people are all around. So during COVID, it had happened. There were online memorials also, which were done, obituaries also, which were, you know, organized because people couldn't travel. There was this fear of COVID. You know, you couldn't go and attend the funeral because of the, you know, doctors had straight away said you cannot touch the body, you cannot do this, but to do certain rituals, so everybody attended, were able to be online together, you know, and to mourn for the you know, the passing of your loved one, and they were doing it together. So I think that was one way which brings you closer to everyone around. You know, somebody might be in New Zealand, somebody might in US, and then, you know, you organize that thing for the sake of others also to be able to join. Secondly, writing posts, not for the sake of likes,
yeah,
or the validation, but for the fact that you're expressing yourself out, you know, how much love is there, which was probably not shared earlier. So that's what I said. Affirmation could be a private letter or private poem or a private scrapbook for that person, or in your prayers to God, if you believe in God. And the other way is also, you know, using the social media as well, you know, where you're expressing your thoughts, your love for that person, you're sharing that memory, and you're celebrating that memory with that person. And that, so it's one of the ways you're honoring the person, but yet through social media. What could be the consequences? Sometimes you have seen, we all have seen certain memes that people clicking pictures, you know, for the sake of likes, for the sake of going viral. Yes, they did go viral, but that was done in a very, I think the connotation and the context was very sad and unfortunate around it. But yeah, there are always certain type of people with certain types of thinking. We cannot control that. So I think that could be probably the, you know, cons of it, because people may use it for gaining popularity in a very that raises questions on their own, you know, self-esteem. That's a different debate altogether. Probably we can have one session on that. But yeah, I think that can be helpful. Social media, you have WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, where you can, you know, post about the person. And it could be done privately also. You could have your own groups. WhatsApp family groups are there where you could talk about it. But the sad part is we all have access to all these things. But how much are you using it? You know, to express yourself, because expressing yourself emotionally, whether you're a man, woman, or belong to third gender, it will not make you weak or weaker. So that is something. So that's what I say, that it is okay to not be okay, and it is okay to cry. It is okay to grieve for somebody, you know, who has passed away. It is okay to talk about them, and there's nothing wrong in that. How else will you honor that person, right? If you, so otherwise you're masking your grief, and that can lead to a lot of issues within you as a person. Some people tend to have abandonment issues. Some people tend to become hyper independent, that we don't need anybody else, or this person will also leave us. This is not healthy, right?
No, very true. And, you know, I know we spoke about the cons of social media, and of course, we recently saw it, right, with certain celebrities sort of faking their death on social media to raise awareness. And of course, that can be very triggering for people who have lost somebody.
Yeah.
So there's obviously that mindfulness somewhere has to come in how we use social media, how we choose to engage with social media. But speaking about social support, and of course, you've emphasized a lot about on how social support has a very, very huge role in terms of, you know, helping somebody who's grieving. And also somewhere we spoke about self-care in terms of grieving, especially if you're not very into rituals. And I think even in COVID, that sort of self-care became very important for people, because they couldn't do the morning rituals that they needed to do. So what would be some advice that, you know, you would give to family members or friends, you know, who are supporting someone who's grieving, or even to an individual to support them, their own selves through grief?
I think when we're talking about somebody else going through it and we supporting them, and that XYZ could be anyone, let's say, you know, because that's not you in that position. So one thing is definitely that, you know, we say that be kind and compassionate, but nobody actually understands the meaning of it. There is very, number one thing I would say is avoiding certain things, which we'll talk about in detail. But, you know, try to probably just check in. People struggle with the fact, what do we write? They will say condolences, may the soul rest in peace. I am so sorry for your loss. I don't think it is required. Condolences, yes, sure. You can just, you know, say, and you can join your hands and send flowers and say that, you know, may the soul rest in peace and things like that. But then, you know, you need to be, people struggle with the fact, should we go there? Should we talk to the person? I think recently more, you know, so sending a message is much better to them than to talk in person. So why talk in person would be difficult? Because you do not know whether that person is going to pick up the call. But it's worth trying, I would say. Just worth trying. Just call that person up. The person doesn't pick up, be okay with the fact that the person is not picking up the call. Let's say if you ask this person, do you need any help? The person says no, and repeatedly says no. That's okay. Just accept that no graciously, because you need to understand the, you know, situation of that person. You can't say that, oh, if I was you. No, it is not you. So just don't say such things. Don't say things like that, you know, oh, this person might be in a better place. Some people may act or react okay to it, but not always. Don't say that jo hota hai acche ke liye hota hai. No, it will not help. Right. And so just the fact being that being okay with the silences, and there would be moments where you'll have awkward silences. The person may not talk also, but you supporting the person with the physical touch, because we are talking about a person with a person. We are not talking about professional here. Right? So you supporting that person and checking upon them from time to time. Just say that, you know, I'm just checking in, whether it's the anniversary time. It doesn't matter how many years have passed away or not. So, you know, people who deal it with in a very healthy way do celebrate the barsis, and they do have certain rituals for it. Do not give suggestions. They do not need suggestion. They just need your support. You being there, you know, ask them repeatedly if they need you. Probably asking them, are you holding up okay? sounds better than asking, how are you? How do you, you know, how do you expect a person would be, you know, would be devastated, would be terrified, you know, organizing or helping the person with the funerals, with the, you know, memorials or prayers, or, you know, how they can honor the person, to just tell the person that, you know, hang in there. You know, we are all there in the situation. Listening more and talking less, you know, being okay with that. I think that's what something you can do. If you're not there in the physical proximity, probably sending a message, asking, checking in. There's nothing wrong in that. You do remember. And trust me on this, this person is going to remember this, that whoever was there to support this person, irrespective of this person not responding back, not reacting back, you know, and that's how it is, that this is what emotional support and, you know, being there, you know, with the person all about. You call the person is not talking, probably crying, that's okay. So we struggle with the fact, so some people think that we only have to talk always. Not really. In such situations, it's okay if the person is not talking. If there is a pause, it's fine. And, you know, coming to the fact that when you are going through it, we usually turn away from the family and friends in these situations because we feel nobody will understand us. But the fact being that we will have to make a conscious effort, the person has left. We are still there towards the family and friends for support. We may not know how to ask for it, but that's the thing to go about it. Be kind towards yourself, you know, using the religion and the spiritual aspects, journaling your thoughts, you know, maybe painting if that helps you, pleasurable activities which provide meaning to you. So that whole concept of how you can make your life meaningful even without that person being there, that's the whole, you know, I think the thing behind it, how you can help yourself. Creativity also helps a lot of people. Hobbies and interests, and, you know, yeah, and self-care. Do not forget, you follow a structured routine. Do not, you know, forget your physical health is also important, as equal to your mental health. So that's about it.
No, I think, you know, you really highlighted some of the common mistakes that people make when it comes to supporting someone who is grieving. You know, whether it's about just sort of, you know, very ambiguous questions, or a lot of times we misunderstand people who are grieving because we're like, you know, you'll ask them, is there anything you need? Or if you need anything, ask me. But as you said, people
Do let me know.
when they're in grief, they may not
Holding
even
up,
know.
okay.
Yeah, most people may not even know what they need, you know, when they're struggling. So yeah, like sometimes you just offer help, like as you said, you know, help them organize things, help them organize a meal, check in on them. If you can visit them, you know, visit them, I mean. But yeah, be reasonable when you visit them, because I think sometimes people forget that as well, that people who are grieving are not like mechanical, like, you know,
They're human beings with emotions.
they're human beings, they have emotions, they get tired. You know, be practical about, ask them what time you can come and see them, because a lot of times I think people need to also detach from 24/7 being in mourning.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot of times when we talk about societal expectations around grief, people really start imposing themselves on you. So don't do that, because I think that's really insensitive. Like, you know, people think, yeah, you should be wearing white, you should be dressed like this, you should be doing this, you should be crying. I think a lot of those things you touched upon, which is great, that you know how everyone's going to go through grief very differently. There's no one size fits all. Everyone's not going to, you know, look the same, behave the same. Some people would engage themselves in being very busy during this time. Like, you know, they would just go all out organizing things, getting things done. Some people would just be completely withdrawn. And I think just holding space for people, as you said, is really, really important. But, you know, just to close the whole conversation that we've had, would there be any parting words you would want to share with someone who might be having a hard time right now?
I would just say that, you know, there is no harm in seeking help. There is no harm in telling people that you need help. There are things you can do for your own self, and there are things you can do and you should do for yourself because you are here and you're needed and you're important and your life is very, very meaningful. And I would probably end the session, Vedika, with, you know, some lines on grief. It's by Rachel Naomi Remen. It says, grieving allows us to heal, to remember with love rather than pain. It is a sorting process. One by one, you let go of things that are gone and you mourn for them. One by one, you take hold of the things that have become a part of who you are and build again.
I think that's beautiful. I don't think I have anything to say or anything to add after, you know, everything you've said, and especially those closing words. So all I'm going to say is thank you so much, Dr. Amanpreet, for being here, for having this conversation, and, you know, for everything that you've shared, for all your insights. I know this is going to help a lot of people, you know, through their grief and just to sort of make sense of what they're going through during difficult times. And for anyone who's watching or listening, if you're having a hard time, please reach out for help. Know that it gets better. And as Dr. Amanpreet also emphasized, you know, it's not weak to ask for help. It's okay to not be okay, but it's okay to also need some help to cope. So till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.